Hi, my name is Travis, and I'm an alcoholic. And I would like to thank Billy for asking me to come out tonight and share my experience, strength, and hope. It's always an honor, and a pleasure, and a privilege to do anything for AA when asked. And I consider it an expression of my gratitude to the program that has helped change and save my life by saying yes to these AA requests. So thank you, Billy. And I haven't, like Billy said, I've known Billy for a few years, and Billy's just one of my, you know, trusted home group and good friends and AA members, and we've shared some stories and some times together. Billy's one of these people who will go to any length for his sobriety and recovery. In fact, there was one time where I met Billy at about 3:30 or 4 in the morning, right up the road from here. And we drove for 4 hours to York, Pennsylvania. And Rich was in the car with us as well. And we got there for this AA conference. We stayed there all day. It was a really great conference. And when it was done, at about 9 o'clock, we got in the car to come back. And Billy looks at me and goes, "That was just a great conference. That was excellent. You know, I feel alive and invigorated. Can you drive?" But that was a good time. So, sorry, Billy. But anyhow, like I said, my name is Travis. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September 30th, 2002. And for those of you that are good with math and good with calendars, you probably realize that I just recently had an anniversary. Unfortunately, I am not good with math or good with calendars. And my sobriety date that I have today is not my original sobriety date. But I'm one of these rare instances where the sobriety date that I have today actually gives me more time in recovery than I had with the original one. The reason being was because when I first came to AA and I had picked up my white chip, and it was about 2 or 3 weeks later, and people are, you know, I'm starting to realize that people remember this date, and they're counting days and time, and I'm like, when was that? And so I figured it all out. I did all the backwards math, and I was like, okay, it was the last day in September. And so whenever I was asked for the first 6 to 9 months what my sobriety date was, I told everybody it was September 31st. And then when I finally looked at a calendar, I realized there was no September 31st, and so my sobriety date is September 30th, giving me one more day. And anyhow, I have been sober thanks to the grace of God and the program of action defined as the 12 steps in AA, good sponsorship, good home group structure, you know, everything that I feel is all a part of Alcoholics Anonymous for just over 3 years, and I'm very thankful to AA for that. My home group is the Buckingham Big Book Group, which is located in Buckingham County. I live and was born in Charlottesville, Virginia, and that's where I lived my whole life, except for the few years that I went away to college. But when I graduated, I returned to Charlottesville. That's where my family's from. It just seemed like the most comfortable place for me to be. I don't really know what I'm going to say. I haven't really put too much thought in this. I guess the best thing I can do is talk about, you know, my experience with drinking, what happened to me along the way, what changed, and what it's like now. I am, like I said, I am alcoholic, and I was not always able to say that or see that in me. You know, my life had, for a long time, my drinking had no consequences. But over the last few years of my drinking, the consequences began to pile up and get bigger and bigger, one on top of each other, in very rapid succession. And that's what led me to at least see that my life was unmanageable and that I needed, you know, some help with that. Wasn't necessarily sure that I was powerless over alcohol or alcoholic. I'd gotten into some trouble, and things weren't going my way, and so I checked into an outpatient treatment center called First Step in Charlottesville, Virginia. And, you know, through that process, they gave me a lot of information and education about alcohol and alcoholism. But the best thing that they did for me was required that I go to 3 AA meetings a week and get a sponsor. It's clear to me that they know as well as I know that if you just do 28 days in an outpatient treatment center and you don't get tied into something that's going to last long term, odds are you're not going to make it. Some people may, I don't know, but probably not if you're alcoholic, because white knuckling it at home with no solution is probably not going to work. So the best thing they did for me was sell me to go to AA and get a sponsor, and that's what I did. While we were having our sessions at the treatment center, I would not say that I was alcoholic, and this kind of perturbed and miffed the counselors. I'd been a drinker since high school and pretty much drank alcoholically from the get-go. I see this now. I was always kind of nervous and shy and anxious. I had fears of what other people thought about me, fears of the future. I would dwell on resentments of the past, and my mind was always racing. And I found right from the get-go that alcohol quieted this down. When I drank, I could find a sense of peace and comfort and well-being that I didn't have when I wasn't drinking. Alcohol was the solution in my life, not necessarily the problem. Unfortunately, it brought along a whole bunch of problems with it, new problems. And once these new problems started to outweigh the benefits of the solution that was providing me, that's when things started to get out of hand. And so I'm at this treatment center, and I won't say that I'm an alcoholic, because I just thought that I was having a good time, I was having fun, I liked the drink, I liked the effect it produced, but I'd never been fired from a job, hadn't lost a wife, didn't have a wife to lose, but none of that stuff. I had been arrested twice, and I had had a near-death accident, but I didn't want to admit that I was alcoholic. I couldn't see it. And the counselor was a little miffed at me. And so there was this test, a series of yes or no questions, maybe like 20 or 25 questions that he had me take. And I took it, and he pulled it out, and he started grading it. And he was explaining to me that a score between like 8 to 12 was borderline alcoholic. 15 was definitely alcoholic. And he said, you know what your score is? 72. And he was like, why can't you see that you're alcoholic? Why won't you admit it? And I was just like, I don't know. But I wouldn't say it. And I guess the reason is that I had misconceptions and preconceived notions and prejudices of what the word alcoholic brought up to me in my life. Whether that was the homeless guy with the long beard and hair and the trench coat living underneath the bridge, or what it was, I don't know, but I wouldn't admit that I was an alcoholic until I had started going into the process of AA and got a sponsor. The first person I met in an AA meeting, as it would have it now, is one of my best friends and most trusted home group members in AA. That was just a coincidence. But when he gave me that white chip, he gave me some really good advice. He said, you should really pay attention to what people say at meetings, and if somebody says something that has weight and depth and meaning to me, to possibly go up and talk to that person, because he would be a good person to be a sponsor. And I remembered that, and about a week later, for the first time I heard somebody say something that was different from everything else I'd heard. I'd already figured out within the first 2 weeks that people were talking about God and higher power and spiritual awakenings, and that brought up a little bit of resentment and fear about what's really going on in here. But I was willing to give it a fair shake. I wasn't going to pass any judgment on AA until I, did it myself and I tried the steps. And I don't know where that willingness right from the beginning came, but it was there. And I was willing to try it before passing judgment. And so I took the advice that my friend gave me. And when I heard this gentleman share at a meeting, and I remember what he said too, it was, God is on the inside trying to get out, not on the outside trying to get in. And for me, that just hit me as something new that I hadn't heard anybody say before. And I was like, whoa. And so I talked to that gentleman. He became my sponsor. And we were meeting for the first time in a public place, and he had his big book, and he basically 12-stepped me right out of the directions from the book. He was talking about his experience drinking until I began to identify with him. You know, he didn't ask me all a bunch of questions about myself, didn't, berate me. He was just talking about himself. And I was like, yeah, I drank like that. I felt like that. I did that too. And we started to have this process of identifying one alcoholic with another. And so I got a sponsor. And that's really where I became to see that I was an alcoholic. Because as we were identifying with each other, and he was started talking about the doctor's opinion in the book of the definition of an alcoholic. And that definition is very simple. It's two-pronged, really, that there's a physical allergy that once I put alcohol into my system, something happens. I can't control how much alcohol I take. Almost every time, guaranteed, I'm just going to drink and drink and drink and drink until the job is done, until I either black out, pass out, fall down, puke, gray out. I mean, I did all those things. And another part's the mental obsession. That if I'm not drinking, because I could stop drinking, and in those times where I wasn't drinking, it's my mind starting to think about it. Am I thinking about drinking? Am I thinking that alcohol may help with this? And that was true. Both those things, I began to realize that yes, that no matter what, whenever I drank, I got drunk. Even if I told myself, I have to work tomorrow. It's a Wednesday night. I'm going to go to the bar. I'm going to have two beers. And then I'm going to come home. That never happened. I would get those two beers in me. And I would stay at the bar till closing. And a lot of times I wouldn't even go home then. We'd just go out and stay up all night. Other times, instances, if I had an important, family dinner or family function to go to, and I said, well, I'm going to have a couple drinks before I go. Well, what would happen is I'd end up having six or eight and then calling and saying, hey, I can't come. I'm not feeling too good because I didn't want my parents to see me drunk. And that was a big thing for me. I started drinking in high school, and I kind of sensed that they wouldn't approve. So I always, through my whole life, I kind of kept it a big secret from them. But anyhow, so once I realized what an alcoholic was, it dawned on me that that is how I drank. That as soon as I started drinking, I couldn't stop. My favorite beer was Newcastle. And Newcastle's kind of an expensive beer. And I would buy a 12-pack on Mondays with the intention that this 12-pack was going to last me through the week. But I would drink two beers a night. And what would happen is I would sit there and I would drink my two beers. And I would stop. But over the next half an hour to 45 minutes, I would be like going crazy, biting at the chomp where I couldn't. I had to go get that third one. And once I got the third one, I'd polish off eight or nine of them, go to bed. So now it's the next day, it's Tuesday after work, and I only got two or three beers left. But I'd spent all my money the night before, so I'd go down the store and get like a six pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon or something. Carry me through the next night. But anyhow, so I began to realize what an alcoholic was and identify with it. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is really all about at the beginning, is to identify with another alcoholic, because one alcoholic can help where no other person can. Another definition that I've come across in the big book of alcoholics is the either or. And it's just, if either of those things happen, if when you do drink, can you not control how much you drink? Well, that's a definite. That was me. Because once I drank, I could not control it. Or if when you try to quit, you find that you can't quit entirely. It's just, if one of those two things happen, you're an alcoholic. So to have a definition of this, presented to me, but more importantly, identifying with another person that as he described what it is, but follow that up with his life experiences and how that made him act and behave, and that I was able to say, yes, I did that too, is when I became to admit that I was an alcoholic. So what happened to me to, get me to realize that my life was unmanageable? Well, there had been minor consequences all through high school and college, and for about the 8 or 10 years after college that I was still drinking, you know. I passed out in an inner tube on the James River once. I fell off bar stools, fell down steps. I was definitely a puker. That didn't seem to bother me. I just took that as part of what went on with drinking. All sorts of things. Minor car accidents, fights with friends, but no real major consequence to really smack me around and make me open my eyes to what was going on. Like I said, I believed alcohol was the solution. It made me feel better. It had a great effect, and it made me feel, gave me a sense of comfort in my own skin. My mind slowed down. I wasn't worried about what people were thinking about me, what may happen in the future, dwelling on some resentment of the past. But, you know, there was a pretty long run there from like age 16 to, you know, 28 where nothing bad happened. And I was drinking and driving and getting drunk all the time. So eventually you gotta figure, if you roll the dice that many times, you're gonna crap out sooner or later. And that's pretty much what happened with me. The first incident, I was arrested after going to a concert in up near DC. We had been drinking all day, started at like 11 in the morning, you know, drank in the parking lot till 5 or 6, went into the show, continued drinking, show was over at 11 or 12, got in the car to drive back home, kept drinking, got lost. We were actually in Columbia, Maryland, and we were going back to a friend's house in D.C. He was not in the car with us. We had written directions to get there. We got lost right around Capitol Hill. And if you've ever been there, it's a lot of one-way streets that have the same name, like 4th Street East or 4th Street West. So we were kind of like just off, but we were pretty close. We stopped at a gas station to call to get directions. And I noticed that the way my car was parked, the headlights were shining out into the street. And that just like, that's not considerate or polite. These other drivers have this light shining in their eyes. So I cut the headlights off, but left the car running. After we got the directions, I got in the car. It was running. I just pulled off driving, never cut the headlights back on. Didn't get very far, maybe about a half a mile. I got pulled over for driving with no headlights. After drinking all day, I didn't stand a chance. I mean, we had 4 people in the car. We were all drunk. It smelled like alcohol. I was drunk. You know, they knew. I tried to, of course, like a good alcoholic, lie and say I was sober and hadn't been drinking that much, but it was a done deal. As soon as I tried to take the field sobriety test, I was stumbling, you know, arrested on the spot. My blood alcohol content that night was 0.19. That was a very fortunate figure for me because I was arrested in the District of Columbia. Federal laws applied. If I'd been either in Maryland or Virginia, I probably would have been in a lot more trouble. But for whatever reason, the District of Columbia has had, you know, a crack addict for a mayor, reelected. Their laws are a little less, you know, stringent than Virginia's and Maryland. They had a program for first-time offenders as long as their blood alcohol content was below 0.20. So I made it by the skin of my teeth. You know, I had to go to alcohol safety awareness classes, psychiatric counseling, and be on probation for a little while. But once I did all that, I was able to go back to court. They dismissed all the charges, dropped the case, and wiped my record clean. Thank you very much. That was just lucky. You know, I was just lucky. I don't know why that happened, but I'm very glad that it did. And that did nothing to change the way I drank. Not a thing. When I went to the counseling, I lied through my teeth to these people. I did not give them a fair shake. And this was the second time in my life that I'd been to a counselor. When I was 19 years old, my mom told me that she wanted to take me out to lunch and buy me some clothes. And I was like, oh, well, that's nice. That sounds like fun. So we got in the car. She took me to a psychiatrist instead. And, So, Needless to say, what I thought was the solution in my life, other people were probably seeing as a problem, but I wasn't going to admit that. And so at that time, too, I lied to my teeth to this guy. You know, I wasn't ready to accept any help. I didn't want it. I wasn't going to do anything they asked or suggested of me, and I was going to lie. And so that's how I did it after this arrest. I was only there because I was court-ordered to do so, and that by doing so, I could get my record clean. Same thing with the alcohol safety class. I went there. I did not want to be there. Almost, it was, I think, once a week, may have been twice a week, for about 2 hours from like 5 to 7 in the evenings. So I'd go after work, 7 o'clock, I'd get out of there, and I'd go straight to the bar or stop at the store and buy a 12-pack on my way home. You know, I did not want anything to do with this. It was all just a matter of convenience for me to have my record wiped clean. So that did nothing to change my alcoholic drinking. The second major event that happened about a year later was what I referred to earlier as a near-death accident. Again, I'd been drinking all day. This time at the downtown Charlottesville amphitheater, not the new crazy tent one they have now, but the old one. And it was the very first year they had an event there called the Blues and Brews Festival. And there were some bands and all these like exotic beers to sample. And, of course, I sampled way too many. And when it was over, about 5 or 6 o'clock, you know, I was just skin warmed up. So went home, continued drinking. Friends of mine called, so they were out partying up past Monticello on 53 going towards Palmyra. So drove up there, went to this farmhouse, and proceeded to drink fairly heavily till about midnight or 1 a.m. And like I said, I was very practiced at the art of driving and drinking. It was nothing new to me, just what I did. I'm very glad and grateful today that I never caused really, you know, any major accidents involving other people. But with this one, there was a long farm road up to this farmhouse. I'd never been there before. It was night, and it looked like all open field everywhere, so I decided to do a three-point turn to turn around when I was leaving his house. And basically what I did was, as I was backing out, I backed right over the edge of a very steep hill. It was not all open field. It was a five-foot-wide edge of grass next to the driveway, and then it dropped off down to a pond. And so this hill was very steep. I mean, we're talking like this. And the truck was on the side, and I was trying to get it in four-wheel drive to climb back up onto the road. It was a stick shift, and I guess at one moment of engaging the clutch and the gas, it rolled back, being on the steep hill. And when it did that, the two driver's side tires came up off the ground, and it flipped over one time completely, and then another half. So we were at the bottom of the hill, upside down. Wasn't hurt. I wasn't wearing my seatbelt. I had bounced all around through the cab. I had my roommate and best friend's sister in the truck with me. She was seatbelted in. She wasn't hurt either. I did not realize that we were in a pond. I thought we were on solid ground. So I went to open the door of the truck, and water started gushing in, and that kind of freaked me out a little bit. So I shut the door. And as I shut the door, that was too late. The seal was broken, and water was filling up in the vehicle. You know, it filled up to my knees, filled up to my waist, filled up to my belly button, filled up to my chest. By this time, I was getting very scared. I was drunk, really didn't know what was happening, thought we were going to die, even to the point that I looked at my friend and said, "Nancy, I'm sorry. I've just killed you." And luckily for me, she was a little, you know, more thoughtful and knew what was going on. She said, "Well, we're not dead yet. Let's roll down the window and swim out." It's a good idea. So we rolled down the window. We swam out and climbed back up this steep hill, went back to the door of the party and knocked on the door, standing there soaking wet. They were like, "Oh, my God, what happened?" We told them the story. And now, at this moment, I am not thinking to myself, I've just totaled my truck, almost killed myself, almost killed my best friend's sister. I am never going to drink again. That was not what was going through my mind. What was going through my mind was, my nerves are shot. I need something to drink. So I asked my friend, whose house we're at, do you have anything to drink? And he was like, no, Travis. The party was over. Everybody was going home. In fact, you had the only beer. You had about 8 beers left in your 12-pack, and you were taking that home with you. And I was like, you're right. So I went back down that hill, dove in the pond, and swam back in the truck. Now, when I got in there, it had not filled all the way up with water. There was still about an air pocket that big, so I was able to actually take a deep breath, swim in, and then get my head back above water and sit up in the truck for a moment and get my thoughts together. And the beer was no longer in the box of the 12-pack. I had to find it and gather that up. And it also occurred to me that all my keys were still in the ignition, you know, house key, work keys, things like that. I should probably grab those too. So I grabbed the keys and the beer and swam back out. By this time, the guy I was supposed to meet at my house had called, wondering where I was. They told him what had happened. He drove back out there, picked me up. We went to my house. I took a shower, changed clothes, and we went out to the bar. I left my truck in the pond. This all happened on private property. There was no need to call the police. It would have been bad if we had. The next day, when I got out there in the daylight to see what was there, you can see the level of the pond with 4 tires sticking out above the water. And luckily, we were right on the edge of the pond. I don't know how deep it was in the middle. I'm sure had it been deeper and sunk further into the water where it was completely submerged, it could have been a lot worse. But that's where my alcoholism takes me. The desire to drink, you know, led me to do some pretty crazy things. And but again, that fear of death did nothing to curb my drinking to the point that I left the truck in the pond and went out drinking that night. You know, it did nothing. A couple days after that, for like 2 or 3 days, I was sick. I was physically sick and nauseous. Now, I don't know if that was because of the fear that was instilled in me or whether it was just some sort of mucky, nasty pond water that I had drank in, and it was like a biological, physical thing. I don't know. But that did nothing to curb my drinking. And those two events all took place within a year of each other. And before the next year passed, I was arrested again. Almost the exact same circumstances as the first one. Except that it was a Friday night. I had partied all night, gone to bed at like 4 in the morning, and gotten up the next morning at like 11 to drive to North Carolina to see an old college friend for a barbecue kind of cookout party. And along the way, getting close, I decided it was time to crack open that first beer. I did. And soon after that, in this little kind of small town in North Carolina, just across the borderline from Virginia, in the middle of the afternoon on a Saturday, there was a roadblock. And the fact that I drank it so heavily the night before, it was probably easy to smell. The fact that I had just drank in a beer not 5 minutes down the road. And so when I blew into the breathalyzer, it registered pretty high. The cop didn't want to believe me that, you know, I only had one. I'm sure it was because it was, you know, so fresh in my mouth that made it register so high. And so after about 20 minutes of questioning me in the car, when he asked me to do it again, just for whatever reason, I was, you know, stupid and being a smart aleck, I was just like, what do you mean do it again? I already did it once. And he was like, that's it, you're under arrest. You know, probably had I done it the second time, enough time would have lapsed that the alcohol that was fresh in my mouth, the, you know, the blood alcohol content in the breathalyzer would have gone down. I don't know. But I was arrested. There were other things in the car as well. I had quite a few charges on me. And I'm sitting in jail in North Carolina, and their laws were... a little bit different than the D.C. laws. In D.C., I was able to get right to the judge, and they, you know, just gave me a court date and sent me on my way. Here, that wasn't going to happen. The magistrate was going to hold me in jail till I posted bail or bond. And, you know, I'm in 3 hours away from home with nobody to come get me. And that's really when I was hit with the shame and guilt of all the lies that I'd been telling for my whole life to my family, of putting them through this again after the first arrest. And I was like, oh, this will never happen again. You know, I'm not going to do this stuff. And I was caught in all my lies, and there was so much shame and guilt. And you add into that the fear of sitting in jail and what's going to happen this time. You know, is my life ruined? That I was just, I was a mess. I didn't have anybody to call but my parents. And, you know, I'm fortunate that I have, you know, two loving and caring parents. You know, they never did anything to me growing up. They never spanked me. They never hit me. They never abused me physically, emotionally, or anything. They were great parents. I can't blame anything that went wrong in my life on them. You know, they were all my choices that I made along the way that caused all the trouble in my life. And, you know, they could have, at this time, been upset with me and turned their back on me. You know, I don't know. I don't have any kids. I don't know how parents think or react. But they came and got me. It's another, you know, twist of fate that worked out in my favor. Is my mom owns a small business. And that Friday evening, she hadn't been able to get to the bank to make the week's deposit. And she just happened to have $1,200 cash in the house so that they could come on that Saturday and bail me out of jail in North Carolina. If not, they, you know, I would have sat there till at least Monday, maybe Tuesday. Came and got me, put me in the car, and didn't say a word. It was the longest ride I've ever been in all my life. But for me, that's where I hit bottom. That's where I surrendered. The weight of the world was on me with all that fear and guilt and shame and remorse. It was so heavy. And I came back to Charlottesville, and I was working. And I would come home from work, and I would lock the doors, unplug the phone, pull the blinds down, and go to bed right at 5:30 every night. I was a mess. And that's what led me to realize my life was unmanageable. Not that I was alcoholic. Checked into that first step treatment center, and that subsequently led me to AA, where I met my sponsor, realized what the definition of alcoholism is, and I'm able today to say fully without a doubt that I am alcoholic. And, you know, like I said, for whatever reason, right from the get-go, I was just willing to try it. I had never tried to stop drinking before in my life. When I was arrested the first time, had the near-death accident, nothing. I'd never tried it. I didn't know. You know, the few psychiatrists or counselors I'd been to, I'd lied to, didn't give them a fair shake. But I was willing to try AA and just to give it a shot. And right from the get-go, you know, I just took the suggestions and advice of my sponsor. Today, I believe in the whole, you know, program, the whole enchilada of what Alcoholics Anonymous is today, that I can't pick and choose which part of this may be working, but it's the whole thing. It is the, you know, the fellowship, the program of the 12 steps, you know, the praying and meditating, working with others, going to meetings, trying to carry the message, a home group, getting a job in that home group, service commitments, you know, setting up chairs, making coffee, all these things have come together to bring me recovery. And right from the beginning, I allowed that structure to be set into my life through the guidance of a sponsor. He told me to go to 4 or 5 meetings a week. He told me to get there early so that I could meet people and become part of the fellowship. He told me to stay late, help clean up, and continue enjoying the fellowship. you know, what part is this of this does this have to do with my recovery? Well, you know, what it did was it gave me a sense of responsibility and maturity and commitments in my life. There's been many times that those habits have saved me when my butt was on fire. Most recently, about a month ago, I had an old friend show up that I hadn't seen in about 3 years. You can do the math there. But he came to my house and he wanted me to, you know, help him out with a favor. And I immediately sensed it was wrong and it made me feel uncomfortable and it was probably a bit dishonest. But at that moment, the self-centered fear of wanting this guy to like me and wanting, you know, not for him not to be like, oh man, you've changed, what's wrong with you, you know. I totally dropped the ball on what I know about the Alcoholics Anonymous steps of, you know, pausing, praying, trying to bring God into this to help make my decisions. And I just slipped right into self-centered fear and did what he asked me to do. It made me feel very uncomfortable, and I felt really awkward. And I was, you know, sitting at home, and I was a nervous wreck about what I had done. But the fact was that at that exact moment, I also had an AA meeting commitment to go open up a church and start setting up and making the coffee. I didn't have time to sit around in my house and worry about these things. And I got out, and I did what had become habit and part of my life. And immediately when I saw a good, trusted friend, I explained what I had done. And, you know, he tried to calm me down a little bit. Got home later, talked with another AA member, got in touch with my sponsor. I explained all this to my sponsor. And he gave me, you know, the greatest, simplest thing ever. He was like, Travis, no one amongst us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. And we are not saints. We all drop the ball along the way, try to get some sleep. I was like, wow, you know, thanks a lot. Because that was like, it just calmed me so down. It wasn't, you know, that big of a deal. And but that's, you know, part for me, that's part of the solution, is all the structure of AA in my life around me. More importantly, I think it is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, I'm a firm believer in all of the program, but I also believe that when you open up to the title page of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that the World Service Organization of Alcoholics, you know, AA, has listed right in there what all the literature is about. And it says that the big book is the story of how hundreds of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Throughout the book, there are phrases like, this book is designed, its main object is for you to find a power greater than yourself, which can solve your problems. It is designed for you to have a spiritual experience to bring God into your life. And that's, to me, what the program's about. It does say about the 12 and 12 that that's just an interpretive commentary on the program. So for me, the directions for how to take the steps are written down in the big book. I heard something that I really liked yesterday, I believe it was, and it was that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is not the solution to my problems. It's the actions, taking the actions described in the big book, which will be the solution to my problems. And that's to me what it is. It's, you know, it's directions. There are written down directions for how this program basically has been passed down through the years. And I allowed right from the get-go my sponsor to walk me through that book and show me where these directions were, and I followed them to the best of my ability. You know, there's some work involved in that. You know, there's writing inventories, sharing it with my sponsor, starting to pray and meditate, coming up with what I believe God is. My parents raised me in a Christian household. They took me to church and Sunday school. But I never had any idea of what God was all about. Had no concept of God. Didn't know how to pray and meditate. Just didn't get it. And you know, by the time I was 16, I'd quit going to Sunday school, quit going to church, and was just out there doing my own thing. So I didn't know anything about God. So this whole idea of me being allowed to come up with my own concept of God was really important to me. You know, I didn't have somebody pushing their idea of God and their dogmas and traditions and their religion on me. I was able to come up with my own concepts of this. And that was really important to me. As well as in the second step, you know, when it talks about we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. But in the second step, it wasn't asked of me, do you now believe? Are you going to be a believer? It was, you know, do you believe or are you at least willing to believe? And I could be willing to believe, you know, because I couldn't prove. In my mind, I went over this intellectually, and it was like, you know, I haven't been to every nook and cranny of the universe. I can't say 100% without a doubt that there is no God. So that means that maybe, by some stretch of the imagination, some long shot, that maybe there is. So I was willing to at least believe that. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about progress and growth. And you got to start somewhere. So with that just little bit of willingness to believe that maybe, that's where my beginning was. And I had also already identified with my sponsor the way he described his drinking and all the things he'd done. We were so much alike. It was pretty scary. I mean, even down to like some of the same things we had done in life, some of the things, same things we had been arrested for, even to the music we liked. And I was like, if this worked for him, then it'll probably work for me too. And I had made that connection as well. And so I did. You know, I did the legwork of the steps. I started to come up with my own concept of what God was to me and began to pray and meditate and try to forge and create this new relationship with God. Now, I fell into a couple traps of AA along the way. The first one I fell into was that it was about breaking the big book apart and being able to know what every word meant and, you know, saying what this paragraph means and just being the super genius of knowledge on what the AA book meant. And that's not it at all. It's just about taking the descriptions of the actions in there and performing them to the best of my ability. The second trap I fell into was that I have to become a spiritual giant. That I have to pray and meditate all the time and be so close to God that the light of heaven shine down upon me and all my problems go away and I will never feel fear or resentment or anger or frustration or bitterness again. You know, that's not what it's about either. It's just simply about trying to go forward with these principles of kindness and tolerance and patience and loving others and being of helpfulness and service to others. And if I'm just trying to do the best I can, because there's no way that I can be a saint or a monk or a priest or a pastor or any of those things, you know. I'm much better at being a sinner, because that's how I was my whole life. And I can still fall into those traps today, but that's okay, as long as I continue to stay in the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it is a process and it's about growth. And like I said, that's where the whole structured lifestyle of having lots of meetings to go to and committed meetings to go to and a sponsor and discussing these things and not keeping it in and just being open to suggestions and directions has really saved my butt a few times. But again, you know, I'm talking there's this work that had to be done as part of the program of the steps. And I went along with it, and you know, the eighth and ninth step, I believe, are some of the most important steps there are to get out there and make these amends. Had lots of fear involved with some of these, but what it did was it got the weight of my conscience off of me. And that's important in the beginning. I think the steps at first are designed to, you know, to kind of start to slowly make me feel better, to get some of the stuff off my chest, and to allow me to start bringing God into my life. But as we go along, it changes, and it becomes about other people. And how can I be of best service to those around me? How can I quit being the tornado in the lives of others and wrecking their lives apart. And but making the amends was, you know, hugely important. I was on probation when I first started making the amends. I had a lot of fears about going to employers to tell them that I stole from them and whether they were going to call the cops and whether the cops were going to come and, you know, press charges and that my probation was going to fall through and I was going to go to jail. You know, that didn't happen. In the book, it talks about, you know, amazing things happen when we go to places with God and try to do the right thing and set things straight. And that was my experience with the amends. I did my family first, people that were closest to me, that are most likely going to be closest to me for the rest of my life, or theirs, depending. And so I did them first, but as I started to go back to make these financial amends to employers and, you know, stores, you know, as I said, I don't know if I said it, but growing up, I was a liar and a cheater and a thief. I had morals. My parents had taught me this stuff. I just couldn't live up to it. I wanted the rest of the world to think I did, and I'd try to keep all this stuff hidden from everybody so that people would think that I was this great, upstanding, honest, you know, Joe American, but that wasn't the fact. And so I had to go back and I had to make these amends. And I was told that you just go to people, you tell them what you did, you tell them you're wrong, and you ask them how you can make it right. And then you do what they say. And some cases it was easy. I knew I had to give the money back with interest. Other things weren't so easy. Like all the times I had missed the family functions. And when my mom said, well, you know, there were lots of times when we asked you to come over and you never would, or we asked for some help and you always said you were too busy. And for that amend, the easiest way for me to do that is now when she asks me to come over to dinner, I say yes. You know, and I'm now a part of their life. I'm trying to rebuild that relationship with them and be an active participant in their lives. One employer I went back to, I had pilfered gas from the, they had a, you know, one of those big 500 gallon tanks for gas. It was a landscaping company. Fill up the work trucks. Every once in a while on my way home, I'd slip around my own personal vehicle and top it off with gas. So I went back to tell him. He was familiar with someone who had been in AA for a long time. He knew I was in AA. When I called him and told him that I wanted to speak with him in person and asked if we could meet somewhere, he told me that he was pretty sure that I was coming to make amends. And for a couple of days, he racked his brain wondering what it was that I had done to him. And so I sat him down. I explained to him that, you know, every once in a while I took 5 or 10 gallons of gas, and that it probably wasn't that much, that I totaled it up to be maybe about $75 worth, that I was willing to give him $100 to pay for that gas and make it right. And he didn't take my money. He took me out to dinner, and over the course of that dinner, offered me my old job back with a, you know, a much greater pay increase. That's what making amends did for me, and these things were amazing. I did not accept his job offer, but I was able to use that with my current position and go to my employers and say, hey, I got this job offer, and they gave me a raise to keep me. So it did, you know, pay financial benefits. Me trying to make amends brought financial blessings in my life. And, you know, what causes that? To me, it's clearly the grace of God in my life, that when I'm trying to do the right thing and make things right, then, you know, good things happen in my life. But as I said, you know, going through the steps, it becomes, how can I be of maximum service to those around me? Steps 10 and 11 are all about, you know, praying and meditating and improving my conscious contact with God, pausing when when full of fear and resentment and, you know, bitterness or dishonesty, frustration, to pray and ask God for God's help to remove these things. But it goes further than that. It says, and then to turn my thoughts towards another person that I can help and be of service of. And I'm a big, big believer in the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous. When my mind is racing and those self-centered fears come back and I'm worried about the future or dwelling on some resentment of the past and my mind's racing, if I'm going to a meeting with the idea of how can I be of service here, what can I bring to the table, how can I help somebody, and then try to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, not the message of my counselor, not the message of my church, not the message of my parents. Those may be good messages, and they may be able to help somebody, but Alcoholics Anonymous wants me to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, that if you take the steps, you too can find the God of your understanding, and God can come into your life and help solve your problems. Alcohol just being, you know, the tip of the iceberg. So when I try to carry that message, and I'm trying to be of service to those around me, or if I'm sitting down and working with the sponsee, listening to their problems, really trying to, you know, show them what the spiritual solution to this may be, well, my mind quiets. And I'm not worried about whatever little piddly problems that I may have in my life. That just kind of goes away, and I feel better. I really do. Those are the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. It gives me a spiritual way of living that I can't be perfect at. It's impossible for me to be perfect at, just by the nature of being a fallible human being. But I can try my best. I can wake up in the morning and pray and meditate and ask God to come into my life and ask how I can be of service to help others. And when others around me start to get on my nerves and I get full of self-centered fear and frustration and bitterness and resentment, to not act like the jerk that I'm prone to being, but to step back and pray and meditate and again ask God for the help for these things to do, and I can act like a spiritual being. May not be feeling it. I may be angry as all get out, but I can calm myself down. These are tools, a way of living that make me a more productive worker, makes me a better relationshiper. Now, I'm sure I sometimes get self-centered in my relationships, but through the process of AA, I can usually start to see that and then try to change and hopefully put my best foot forward and try to, you know, help them more than worried about my own little designs and plans. There's something else I had on my mind a second ago, and it seems to have slipped away. So rather than sit here and try to think of that, I'm just going to stop there. Thank you again, Billy, for inviting me. It is always a pleasure and an honor and a privilege to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous and to do anything when asked. And I'm very grateful for what AA has done in my life. It has just made me a better person. In fact, this morning I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and starting to cop a resentment while I was sitting there in the meeting because the chairperson wouldn't call on me. I'd had my hand raised for a half hour and everybody else around me was getting called on. And I was feeling selfish and self-centered. And at the end of the meeting, I realized that they do the little chip thing to mark your time and sobriety, and that she hadn't handed the basket of chips out. And I'm thinking to myself, if she comes up to me to ask me to do the chips, I'm going to say no, because I'm resentful right now. But what happened? She stood up, she walked it over to me, asked me to do it, and I acted better than I felt. I said, yes, of course, I will do the chips. And I stood up, and I didn't say anything mean or resentful. I just, politely as I could, passed out the chips. And that is proof of Alcoholics Anonymous working in my life, that I'm going to act better than I feel through the process of these steps and good sponsorship and home groups and jobs and service commitments and all the stuff I've been talking about. So thank you for listening, and thanks again for asking me to share.